Hey everyone, welcome to Exploring Health, Macro to Micro. I'm your host, Parker Condit. In this show, I interview health and wellness experts around topics like sleep, exercise, nutrition, stress management, mental health, and much more. So by the end of each episode, you'll have concrete, tangible advice that you can start implementing today to start living a healthier life. This is another episode of On the Floor. This is the monthly segment with my co-host, Danielle Pellicano. In case you don't know, Danielle is a great trainer and endurance coach and is also one of my best friends. So if you want to learn more about Danielle, please check out episode 3, where she's a guest in the typical conversational interview format. For any new listeners, On the Floor refers to being on the gym floor. Danielle gathers questions from people on the gym floor, and we spend 10 to 15 minutes answering those questions. Today's 3 questions are, what are strategies for parents at home to move and live a healthier lifestyle? This is more so for their kids, and this is a question coming from a PE teacher, an elementary school PE teacher. The second question was somewhat ambiguous, but it had to do with external and internal motivation. Danielle and I just ran with this one and talked about kind of our own strategies and our own thoughts about external versus internal motivations. And then the third question is, what is the best running zone for a 53-year-old woman? We take this question in a few different directions, but I think all of these were great questions. And she and I are kind of starting to hit our stride as how we actually attack these questions and work together as co-hosts. Hopefully, if you've been listening up until this point, you can sort of tell and see how we're progressing as we do this together. So without further delay, I hope you enjoy the 4th installment of On the Floor with Danielle Pellicano. Danielle, welcome back on the floor. This is episode 4 now. Thanks for being on here again.
Of course, love it. Anytime, right, so, spent with you, Parker.
I know this is our time to catch up.
This has become our time, which we need to discuss this after this podcast.
Yeah. So in episode 3, you mentioned that you had just experienced a rib fracture, 4 ribs. Not the first time this has happened. And I kind of alluded to a previous time. So I'll share before we get into the actual episode.
I mean, you have to.
Yeah. So when I was still living in Colorado, I came down to visit you in Scottsdale. And when you came to pick me up at the airport, you said, hey, there's a place here where we can go bull riding. And I said, oh, well, we're doing that, right? And you go, yeah, we're doing that tonight. People had warned me that bull riding is dangerous. And I was like, yeah, sure. Anyway, so we went bull riding. I broke my back. You broke your ribs.
Yeah.
So it turns out it was actually just as dangerous as people warned us of, but still very worth it. And, you know, I was just coming down here to check out Scottsdale. And I was like, this place is, we went bull riding on night one. We spent the rest of the weekend in urgent care in the hospital. And I was like, Scottsdale's awesome. And I moved here 6 months later.
That's right. So that was a recruitment trip.
So anyway, you're pretty experienced with dealing with cracked ribs or fractured ribs at this point.
Is true.
So
I am.
Yeah. So anyway,
pay to play. Pay to play.
Yeah, exactly. You live that sort of lifestyle, but
I do.
We're all wishing you a speedy recovery.
Thank you. We do have
an upcoming race season. I'm probably at the point right now where I should be training more than I am.
I'm curious, where is your training at? Real quick, just throw me one nugget.
Okay. I ran 3.5 miles yesterday.
Okay.
Pretty slowly. And I probably hadn't run for 10 days before that. So not great, but I'll ramp it up soon.
Okay. Thank you for that answer, actually. Now I don't feel so behind.
Yeah, no, I will start sharing kind of, I think at this point, this is going to come out way later, but when we're actually recording this, I think I'm like 16, 17 weeks out. So we're in a good spot. I just got to start doing more uphill work. And I don't know, maybe we end up doing an episode kind of outlining our training at some point.
Love it.
Okay. All right. So again, on the floor, the format is getting questions. Danielle gets questions from people on the floor. We answer those questions to the best of our ability. One of the questions is a little bit ambiguous today, so we're going to use we'll use our best judgment to see what we think she was asking. But anyway, we're going to start off with the first question, which is great. We don't necessarily know his name, but he kind of looks like a Matt. So if you end up watching this, please let us know your name. This is a great question, though.
All right. As an elementary PE teacher, I'm always trying to combat childhood obesity. What strategies do you have for parents at home to help their kids move and live that healthy lifestyle?
Great question.
Of course.
There's a lot in here. Do you want me to go first or do you have any thoughts on this?
I will. You start. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll start with one topic. Actually, I want to start off by giving a few resources. One is that I have a few Instagram accounts. So I think there's two ways to take this. One is talking about the fact that for kids, physical activity needs to be fun. It needs to be a game. And I think the opportunity there is that I think it should be fun and game-like for adults too, especially if it's not something that's part of your lifestyle, right? If a lot of what kids are going to get is from observing the activity of the parents. So if the parents aren't doing active things, it's going to be harder for them to adopt those lifestyles, right? So much of it is just driven from what they're observing and the environment that they're in. So a great way to kind of do it with your kids is by turning it into a game. And if you don't know how to do that, there's a very good Instagram account called Young Athlete Training. I will link that. And you can just watch a few of the reels. They're all very short, but it just gives you a very good idea of like, how can you make planks more interesting? And it, like, he's in a plank and he has a cone and he's trying to flip it and land it on itself. So you kind of go into a one arm plank, you flip it, you try to land it. So it just gives you examples of games and how you sort of gamify a lot of different fitness options. Because otherwise, if you're looking at a parent, be like, how do I make this fun? It can just be like another big burden of like the mental load of how do I figure out how to make this engaging? So it's a very good account. It's growing very quickly. So clearly a lot of people are getting value from it. And I think it's just a really good place to get resources for how can I do fun things with my kid around the house. But I have other things to talk about, but I'll bounce it back to you for your thoughts.
Well, I was surprised, but currently what was the statistic? 15.8% of our youth. So youth were, I'm going with 10 to 17. He's talking elementary. So he's going 4 to 11, I would say, just so we have our framework of what age is. So K through fifth grade. But 16% of our youth is considered obese. So that is being in like the 85th to 95th percentile of being in a BMI over that, which is high. So when to talk body fat, that'd be like 26 to 28%. But as a kid, that's high. You know what I mean? But when he asked me this question, it was very sincere. Like he's very passionate about this, but it's a struggle. But I also think systems need to change. Like I feel we almost need to bring like step count into the youth conversation, right? Like we do it with adults. We have our watches. We make it 10,000. We're excited. I still get excited when my watch buzzes. Like some things have to be where they are held accountable too, and not making it not fun. But I think our standard of the 150 minutes a week is we need to change everything as far as framework because our reality is different now. I think kids, I would say if you sat parents down, their biggest enemy that they're combating is screen time. And if you want to change a behavior, because that was really what his question is, he's like, I'm doing the best I can when I have them for all 30 minutes in the school. But when they go home, how are these people helping me help them understand the importance of movement? And I think it's figuring out those things and having bigger conversations around that. And I know people are going to be listening and they're like, you don't have any idea how hard it is to get your kid off a screen. What I mean is when we would go home, yeah, maybe we still had Nintendo. We still had like game ideas, but the gaming world for kids is on a next level now where it has become where they could talk to their friends through the game. So now playtime has become where I'll be like, hey, Parker, let's hop on this. And like, I'm going to sit on the couch and you're going to be in your couch at home. And now we're playing this game, but we're not moving whatsoever. Just a joystick. I feel like limiting screen time and making it a habit when you get home from school where we used to have to actually go out and play. Like you had to, even if you didn't want to, your parents were like, here's a cookie. Go run outside and go make a fort. You know what I mean? Go next door, go knock on Vinny's door, tell Vinny he needs to like do something for an hour with, you know what I mean? But these are things where it's not small. It's actually a big conversation. And I see it with my niece and nephews. Like it has become conditioned where like they come home and they race right down the stairs and they're in front of the television. And I feel bad because parents already have a ton of things on their plate. But unfortunately, it does come back to the parenting of that habit a little bit. Especially when we're talking our kids are 4 to 11 years old. I mean, so that was one big one. I also think PE has become almost an elective in high school. It's not even required. So now we're stripping that activity from kids as well. And we're putting that back on parents to try to incorporate it. So the conversation's so large that it's almost overwhelming. And that's how I could tell he was feeling.
I can imagine. One of the other parts I want to talk about, and we touched on this in episode 3, mm-hmm. which is the importance of muscle. So like, I think I'm kind of getting to a point now where I think I'm less concerned with obesity and more concerned with like, what is your skeletal muscle mass? As like, if I have metrics that I can measure, I think I'm going to care more about muscle mass, because that seems to be at least something that's like a better driver, right? Obesity is such a big problem. Like the best thing that's kind of come out of that space has been like Ozempic and the GLP-1s. But like, I don't know if that's like a viable long-term solution economically.
Like, when's the last time you tested yours?
My muscle mass? 4 months ago.
And what was it? What was the number?
I'd have to check my InBody. I'm not sure.
Okay. I just did mine yesterday. It was like 67.8.
Okay.
Not terrible.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah.
But it's interesting you're making that point. Like, do we even have that as being a benchmark for kids?
Probably not.
Interesting.
But like for kids or adults, it's like, I think the conversation has been around obesity for so long. And, you know, I think there is like there are certain issues with that, certainly from a psychological standpoint. But I think focusing on muscle mass is wildly important. And I'll reiterate some of the points I made last week, in that muscle is a metabolic sink, and it's a driver for metabolic health, in that it helps so many of the functions of your body just operate in a much more efficient manner. So if you can try to prioritize, I mean, I know we're just trying to get kids to move at all, no less put on muscle mass, but it's worth mentioning kind of maybe not focusing on obesity, but for focusing on kids that are being under muscled. Maybe that's a better frame. I don't know. Cause there's a huge psychological aspect to this entire conversation that we're having as well. And on that point, I want to point to another resource, again, on Instagram, but they have an in-person facility as well. It's an account called Physiology First, and I will link to them, where they're focused on teaching probably not elementary school, but probably the age group range that you were talking about, like the 11, 12 to 17, that range, teaching, like their primary education model is understanding your own physiology. Because I think this is another very important thing. We're kind of seeing it right now, where the stresses of today, I think, are greater than of generations in the past. And just like the different amount of inputs, like I was talking about this yesterday with my partner, and we were talking about like how, like, you can spend all day on the computer just consuming information. It's like, I don't think we're meant to consume the volume that we're consuming now. But anyway, the point I was getting at is that most people don't have the capacity, or most people don't grow up with the skills to manage stress and anxiety. So we're just seeing a generation of people who don't have that as a skill set. People who don't understand their own physiology. They just understand that they're feeling a particular type of way, but they can't look at themselves and be like, oh, my respiration rate is higher than it normally is. I can feel my heart rate is higher than it normally is. So this group, they teach people how to kind of, through exercise as a vehicle, how to understand your physiology. Like, when you're feeling a particular type of way, can you recognize that your respiratory rate is faster and you're doing shorter, shallower breaths? And then can you use your own physiology to help regulate yourself and manage your nervous system? Because I think that's an incredible life skill that you can have if you understand how to do it. And you sort of teach yourself that you can manage your own nervous system kind of throughout life, because otherwise it's just another generation of children now, but then it's just going to be adults who can't regulate their nervous system.
I love your brain.
So there was a lot of interesting things to talk about on that topic. I don't know if any of that was useful, but
I'm always going to say too, though, I'm literally always in it. I feel like if you can get your kid interested in some team sport, they don't have to excel at it, especially when you're talking elementary age, but something that gives them the understanding of team, other kids, and activity. I do, again, I put it on parents, and you're like, yikes, but they have to be introduced. It's not like you go once and your kid hates it and that's it. Like, I've had this conversation with my brother and his kids, and I get it. But like, I also am impressed with the fact that he has pushed them all towards experiencing sport when they obviously don't show a talent for it, which is usually around the age of 9 or 10. I'm just being very honest. That, like, you have to be elite, but like, you'll know if your kid really likes the sport by 9 or 10. At least you've given them that understanding. Whereas now you put them in PE, they're used to being in a team environment. It helps offset the PE teacher a little bit, but I also do think PE teachers need to up their game a little bit on making things more creatively fun for kids. I really do. And I bet he is one of them that does, but I do see that some of the PE teachers are still like the math teacher that, you know, that I'm just being honest, that comes in and he's like, all right, like, let's play tag and dodgeball. I mean, I'm like, okay. I mean, can we get past dodgeball as our only PE activity? I mean, to your point, like, it's, you know, there's a lot of resources to use where, you know, you're writing up a workout like you would for anyone. But I do think there has to be a better plan where you're introducing kids to understanding how to have fun. And I do think the after school thing's a big deal, but I know things have changed now. You know, you can't just go out and ride your bike around the cul-de-sac. Like, I can hear people listening to this and being like, it has changed. Everything about it has changed. But that doesn't mean, therefore, we give up by any stretch. You know, it's like, that's where the nutritional piece comes in. Like, as much as fruits and vegetables, we hammer it. How do you introduce those foods to your kid at such a young age that at least they have a broader palate? Truly, that's giving them a fighting chance, to be fair. Also, sleep. It's like, I mean, kids at that age, I think they're needing 9 to 12 hours. That's a lot of time. Is that sleep routine a routine, right? Limiting screen time to them, just like we're telling our adult listeners when their window is closing. The kids are even probably more sneaky about it, to be fair. You know, so all those things do play into weight gain, into non-movement, into going to school tired, and then therefore you're lethargic. So a lot of these things are habits that it's not going to be fun, I think, for a lot of parents having to be that person that has to enforce it. But a lot of that is habitual.
Yep. I will also mention, it's something like, I think the range is 40 to 70% of your body composition is going to be driven by your genetics. So at the end of the day, like, you might just be pushing a rock up a big hill. If you're kind of in that 70% and you don't have great genetics, or your kid doesn't have great genetics. So sometimes there are things like that. And I don't think they're acknowledged enough sort of in the fitness space, mm-hmm. because, you know, most trainers have awesome genetics and don't acknowledge that either. And they're like, everyone should be able to do what I can do. But so much of it, a huge percentage of it, is driven by genetics. And
Then I must be an anomaly. You've met my mother. She would have laughed too. She would be laughing too. Okay.
This is true.
That too. Oh, that was mean and funny all at the same time.
Okay. Last thing I'll say, on the physiology first thing, I have seen a lot of the results out of like what they've been doing. It does seem to be better for that like high school age group.
Yes.
But the thing that I didn't mention that is a huge benefit is like, it gives the kids a feeling of empowerment, and they're like, okay, a lot of this actually is not outside my control. These feelings I'm having are normal, but I know how I can at least manage them. If you start to understand breath work, respiration, heart rate, and just some of your basic physiology points. So anyone who's interested in that, please check out that account. It's excellent. And they have a physical location based in Maine, if anyone's really interested in going out there. Okay. Question number two from Sarah. This is the one that's a little bit ambiguous.
Okay. Motivation. External motivation with your clients versus internal motivation with yourself.
Letting you start.
I like that Sarah threw up deuces after that question.
No, she's great. She's a professor at the U of M. I mean, it made sense. I put it all into context eventually.
No, she seems cool.
She's awesome.
All right. So I'll be honest. I don't really know what the question was. I just had different notes. I'm like, maybe we can just talk about how we deal with different types of clients, or how you deal with them, how I dealt with them in the past. And we could talk about like somebody who has needs high external motivation and has low internal motivation, and then sort of the flip side and how our training philosophies vary based on the type of motivation that the client has. And then we can talk about our own internal and external motivations if you want to.
I think that's perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we were very opposite with the types of clients that we'd end up working with.
1,000%.
Yeah. So I'm like a terrible cheerleader, where I would, in sessions, I would normally stand with my arms crossed like this and I would just like stare. Right. So I'm not like the cheerleader type of trainer at all.
And so I would work almost primarily with extremely motivated individuals. So here in Arizona, the population I worked with primarily was aspiring professional golfers. They were usually in some sort of pro tour already, trying to get to the PGA Tour, highly motivated. And the other group was persistent pain clients. So these are people that were that have been in persistent pain for 10, 15, 20 years. Again, also highly motivated to not feel that persistent pain anymore. And those are the groups that I like. My natural skill set just paired up naturally very well with like their desires. So there was not a lot of discontinuity between sort of what I was good at and what they needed. So that's generally who I ended up working with. And then a lot of times for patient clients that would come in looking for like weight loss or anything like that, where clearly like you can just tell with somebody's body language when they come in, especially to a personal training gym specifically, they're like, I do not want to be here. I'm like, this is not going to be a good client for me, especially around weight loss, because that's so many trainers' bread and butter. Like I just had so many other trainers that I would just send them to because I'm like, they love tracking macros. They love tracking calories and keeping you accountable on like that day-to-day, really specific nutritional side. And many of those clients got great results, but I'm like, I was a terrible trainer for those types of people. So maybe that's not a great answer, but all I can say is that I would just generally work with people who had very high internal motivation.
I looked at it more from the standpoint of like, first of all, because I have to read it like this, intrinsic motivation comes from within, while extrinsic motivation comes from external factors, obviously. So when you're intrinsically motivated, you engage in activities because you enjoy them personally. It's like a personal satisfaction, which also typically means you are very self-motivated. You're doing it because you couldn't not think of going on that run. I'll use myself as an example. I am intrinsically motivated to run because I like the act of running. I don't even run with anything in my ears usually, which we've always talked about. It is my only time where I feel the most creative, and it gives me like a clear space. When I race, I always have always been this way with it. I almost have like positive mantras, not even affirmations, like mantras when I'm suffering, that I'm like, no, you chose this. You are lucky to be out here. Look at where you get to race. Like, those are things of personal self-talk, which has actually probably propelled me to be able to do a lot of the distances I've ended up doing in my own racing. Then I look at the intrinsical part when you have to do something in order to just do it. And I'll use clients as this example. Trust when I say, when you are week 16 into Ironman training or marathon training, it becomes intrinsic that you have, you're not doing it because you love it anymore. You started because you loved it, but that requires you to understand that you're doing it because you want to be the fist pumping, arms over the head person at the finish line, not crawling. But those are like the ways I looked at this answer, because I'm like, how do I answer that? And I do think that kind of might speak to the way she asked it. And if she was asking it from how I coach, that to me was also where I feel that I try to be a good leader by inspiring others through my own discipline and also achievements. So that is external, in my opinion, to some extent. Do you know what I mean? That does feel a bit forced because it's a requirement of my job, in my opinion, to do what I do and to be respected. I would expect that from a coach if I hired them too, right? But that is a motivation that comes from an external drive, that being my clients, and that mean me having to stay looking the part, meaning physically I can't just do it one day because I always have to maintain a certain fitness level to even be able to perform at the level that I'm still expected. But then I think of the expectation. People are like, well, you could coach. Why do you have to still perform? For me, it's because I internally still love it as well. So I don't know if this is answering that, but do you know what I mean? Like, I do think, and what I typically attract is that, I mean, now the beauty of social media and how connected we are, people are able to see you, your results more. They're able to kind of follow you along in your training. They see your coaching style. That's very cool if it's used in the right way. So for me, that's also seeking out an external force, right? To kind of promote stuff in a message that I deeply believe in. So I looked at that. I really liked the question because it made me kind of have to think about my coaching style and my personal training style, right?
Yeah. So I'll just kind of share a little bit about when I'm training, like myself, like what I end up using. I have a lot of like internal motivation. It, like if I decide to do something, I'm just going to do it. But then I use like external elements as like a bit of a incentive or a stick. But it turns out usually by the time it comes like to actually cash that stick in, I usually don't take advantage. The example being like last year when I was running a lot, I wanted to run 1,000 miles and I was like, oh, I'm going to create content around this for a month and a half once I finish it. And like, that was like a big thing to get me to keep doing it in the summer months to stay consistent, yada, yada, yada. I was like, oh, it's like, I gotta stay through this just so I can create. I was like, it's going to give me so much content. And I think I made like 2 posts about it. And just cause like, once I finished, I was like, it felt really good. And I made a video or two about it and I just never really felt the need to post about it again. So it was like, I didn't really cash it in, but I kind of used it throughout the year. And now that I'm getting back into kind of running for or training for the Leadville heavy half, same thing. I'm like, oh, it'd be really cool if I like kind of vlogged through the actual training race and some of the training leading up to it. I'm probably not going to, but that thought gets my ass out the door. So I kind of use that as a driver for action sometimes. So that's kind of how I leverage multiple aspects of it. But
that's also a perfect example, because to your point, like I'm in a very unique lane right now as far as this last year. This is the most on the floor I've been, as you know, too, in years, right? Like most of my endurance coaching is retreat camp based. It's more meeting clients and doing the training in the element. It's online. All their programming goes through Training Peaks. So for me, I am in a very interesting lane, which I'm loving, but I'm almost in 2 compartments right now where I'm with. And when I say general pop, I'm not dismissing people's like athleticism. These are still athletes, but they're only seeking me or seeing me in a group class environment. So that's when I say general pop. And then I have my PEC clients, and I almost push people in the racing category or in that type of goal setting, because it's the only thing that's ever resonated for me personally as well. And that's when you were even referencing weight loss. That is such a huge market. And I too do not attract that clientele. I'm not very good at it. And I've said it. You lose me when it comes solely about body comp and numerics, which is a requirement for that goal to be attained. So it's not me dismissing it or saying or shunning it and saying that's bad. Not at all. That is such another skill set. Whereas you hire me and now I'm talking about training stress scores, watts, power, you know, pace. That is my knowledge. That's where I have to spend any free minute I have reading up on that, where I give as much information as I can, hence even this podcast, in what I understand for that. But for me, I lose motivation when something becomes about only the external appearance, even. It would never have been a motivator for me to start, so that's where we're just different. But it's so important to know your client, because there is one that's going to tick for you more than the other. And that's not me saying, so many people hired me for the longest time to do the Leadville 100. That was like my biggest reputation in Minneapolis because of the buckle. It was a status thing. I was at a party on Friday. This is going to be great. And I had my mother's buckle on, and she was a barrel racer. Awesome buckle. It was a lifetime party. I had people coming up to me being like high-fiving me, thinking it was a Leadville 100 buckle. And I kept being like, wow, like it is a pretty buckle. I'm like, because they know I've done it. But it was shocking to me. That became such a Super Bowl trophy that it didn't matter if you hated every minute of the training for it, because it is a very grueling event, the run and the bike. That the status of having that, though, and I'd be lying if I wasn't like, nah, I obviously need a buckle just for my coaching. The training was brutal. There were no positive affirmations that day. I could promise you that. But when I got that buckle, I don't wear it out to the party and high five. I framed it and I gave Angie the same frame. And it's like something that I look at like a trophy. You know what I mean? I don't use that as a status when I walk out. And I'm not that this is terrible, because I love the people that do. You should be proud of it. But that is the only time I've looked at that where I'm like, that was the most external goal I've ever seen, where people would give their left arm to get that freaking buckle. And they still do. And it's incredible. But like, so I've experienced it. But then I looked back internally and I'm like, no, I've never been about that. I rarely advertise that. Like, you come into my home, there's nothing athletic based, but I'm just explaining it because that would surprise people. You've seen it. You've been everywhere I've lived. Like, you wouldn't even think I was an athlete if you walked in. Like, it's not what motivates me. Mine has always been like the legit beauty of the sport and being out in nature and traveling to go do cool shit.
The last thing I'll note, because I think it's funny, there's a funny example behind this, is the idea that a lot of people, you can leverage social media mm-hmm. for like external accountability. And the problem is you can get validation before you deserve it. So like you can say, I just signed up for this thing. And then a lot of people reach out to you and say, great, good for you. Congratulations. And that feels really good. Less so in the fitness side of things, because at the end of the day, you can see if somebody finished a race, especially races, you can look them up if you know their first and last name. So you can see if somebody actually did it.
Yeah.
But the example this guy gave, and he made a book about it, it's called I'm Writing a Novel. And it was a collection of tweets of people who were tweeting about writing their novel instead of actually writing their novel. The point being, and then he made a book compilation of that because nobody actually wrote the novel, because people who are writing novels actually write, they don't tweet. It's just one of the dangers that you can use it, but understand like the validation coming too soon might be a deterrent at some point. So
well said,
Sarah, fun question.
It really was.
Yeah. It'd be funny if she was like, you guys spent 20 minutes talking
about that. She 1,000% will let me know. Don't you worry. 1,000% she will.
You guys weren't even close to what I was actually asking.
It's going to happen.
Okay. Next one is from Leanna.
Hey, thanks for letting me ask this question. I'm 53 years old. And for my age and for me, is it best to be conditioning running wise in zone 2, 3, 4, or 5?
Cool. Running zones. I think this
is such a loaded question, though, if you think about it. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, my first question is like, what's the goal or what's the target?
I just think once you say over 50, things change entirely. I don't mean it badly. I mean it sincerely. Because as soon as she asked that, I was like, that's a very loaded question because my answer could be a deterrent. You know what I mean? It could deter people. So I'm still going to give my answer, but I'm coming at it not like your textbook, here's your fat burning zone 2, because guess what? We start generalizing it again. And that, if anything, is what I think your podcast is like, you know, pulled the plug on, is we can't generalize anymore. And I have to reference Dr. Stacey Sims because she's been the whistleblower that's been most prevalent for me. You know what I mean? Just like you have people in panel that you've been using on your show, which has been awesome. Like, you find your resources, their information is very science-based. And you have these incredible women that are finally like pulling back the sheet and explaining stuff, because most of the data is based around sedentary men. So as soon as she asked it, I was excited, but I was also like, this is a loaded question. I only want you to talk because I obviously have my thoughts, but I'm curious where you want to go with that.
I was going to say, I kind of wrote out a basic answer based on the response that her goal is to be generally healthy. So I don't know if that is the case, but this is what I would give. Also, not understanding how much time she's committing to it per week. But let's say she's dedicating 3 hours a week to training. Also, because you mentioned fat burning zone, I do want to talk about that briefly, because I think this is not talked about enough, or the clarification is not talked about enough. I think when people hear fat burning zone, which is a thing, that is a zone, it refers to the fat you're burning is in your bloodstream. It's not stored fat. So when people are like, oh, I'm working in my fat burning zone, and most people think they're burning fat that is stored in their body, but that's not the case. They're burning fat that is readily available in their bloodstream. So that's a common misconception. Wanted to clear that up. Happy to talk about that more too. So if she's dedicating 3 hours a week to be generally healthy, I would say 2.5 hours of that should be approximately zone 2, something pretty low level steady state. And then I have 30 minutes of, I just put intensity, because you get to a certain age, you don't know where she's coming from. Like, I don't know how much intensity she can handle, but I'd have about 30 minutes of, let's categorize it as high intensity interval work, but I would do longer intervals, like 4 minutes on, 4 minutes off, just to drive a higher VO2 max. a lot of people can't handle 4 minutes of, at least like 4 minutes of repeats. So what I used to do with people who like truly were not anything endurance based, they're just, I needed to do something aerobically based with them or something condition based with them. I would do a 1-to-1 work to rest ratio, which I think is generally good for some of these longer intervals, not sprint intervals. So 1 minute, I would start them with like 1 minute on, 1 minute off, and just do some amount of repeats with that. So they could do that towards the end of two of their sort of like longer zone two blocks. And that's kind of all I do based on a three hour commitment to conditioning. If she's only dedicating 3 hours a week to exercise, that would change because I'd want to work in strength training. But that's generally my very broad answer on that.
That was a good answer though. That was really good. I'm going to say, so Leanna, she's in her mid to late 50s, because I was taken aback because when I asked her after, I didn't even think she was, like, I wouldn't have put her at that age.
Okay.
She probably comes to my class, which is, I'm going to categorize it as a HIIT class. And I'm going to just say that because you don't stay in any one zone long enough to really form an adaptation, but it's hard.
Well, she said she was 53.
Oh, she did say 53.
Okay. Yeah.
Perfect. Over 50, 53. Okay. What I feel, the more I've been reading and the more I've been getting a lot of these questions, everything's going to come back to how do we hold on to the most muscle mass we have over 40, I'm going to go with. So you and I are going to hammer the protein and the lifting heavier conversation. Again, that's what I meant. I knew we were going to circle back to it, and we're going to probably circle back to it a ton in these, because it's not the one answer for all, but nothing is pivoting from that. When you listen to Dr. Stacey Sims, any of it, they will not abandon that message. Regardless of the question, almost once it's 50, it is how do you maintain the muscle mass you still have? If it's about fitness, so here I got to go into my two lanes again. My endurance athletes, I've read so many things where actually long distance running for women over 50 is a detriment. It is. That doesn't mean you don't pick that goal anymore. But at the same time, those are people that are very goal oriented. This sport is something they love, but now you are playing with fire a little bit because you are only holding on to the mass you have now established in your 30s and 40s, right? And now you're taxing that system at probably its highest. And now it is just, I look at it because it's something like they're blowing the whistle on, and I sit here and it always puts me in an uncomfortable position because I will clearly be that 60-year-old that's probably still doing marathons, right? Because I love it so much. But what does that do? That shifts my focus to how I'm going about my fitness now. So for someone like her, I don't just look at this as like a cardio answer, right? Which I think she might have been probably referencing. I look at a lot of it. So if you're only doing high rep GTX, which is just group fitness, high rep exercises, right? Someone like her needs to be so mindful that she's getting in like 4 to 5 sets of 5 rep maxes in compound movements, right? And if you're not even implementing that, and that's where you're lifting, you can spike to zone 4s and 5s when you lift heavy like that for sure. But for the most part, it's not about zones anymore. It's like, if you're asking me, I'd rather see some of these women that are aging that are already fit in my mind, and they're trying to maintain what they have to pivot their train of thought. Like, that doesn't mean I don't want you coming to class anymore per se, but it needs to be, there needs to be a shift in some of the other things you're truly starting to go after. Right? Because for you, I see what you're saying. Like, 3 times a week resistance training is a minimum. Is a minimum for over 50. It has to be.
Yeah. Like, not knowing her and like not knowing what she's available or what she's able to commit time-wise, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, you just give this answer, I'm like, this is an answer in a vacuum. Right. Where there's no other circumstances that are tailored into this. But yeah, if it was just to kind of prioritize like where she's going to be in 15 years, that's a very different answer than I have 7 hours a week to train that I'm committing to. What should my cardio piece be? And if that's the case, that was kind of my answer.
Yeah. Because I feel like people might be like, well, what's the answer then? I mean, I'm not going to answer it by zones. I don't even want that to be the way we look at it anymore. But again, people are going to be like, that is us. Why I reference it is that that's a person that comes to this class that it's all based on zones. So I get it. I do understand where the question is coming from. And I do think it's awesome that women in their late 40s and 50s are coming to that. I mean, it's like my market right now. It's awesome. However, there needs to be a shift in what you're doing in addition to that. So that is where I was going to take this time to answer it that way, because it's a message that's not going to change. Like, let's be real. A lot of it is, I want to stay healthy, but it's going to come back to body comp. There's something about a shifting, like, let's be real, premenopausal to menopause, like your biggest shift comes 4 to 5 years before menopause. Like, you start to see it. I'm starting to feel it. I'm 44. I'm starting to understand it. I'm still happy with how I look, but yeah, the belly fat around the abdomen, things that are starting to shift. You're only going to start to be able to kind of pivot some of that and change it with heavier lifting. It's proven. You have these women speaking. When you have your panel in a couple of weeks, it's going to be talked about. So protein intake, it's so important. But I think, again, now we're overwhelming our listeners with hitting these metrics. Any improvement is going to be an improvement. Just prioritizing it is going to be a shift, because now it's like, I'm not saying but if you're losing 1% of your body mass, women, muscle mass, starting at 40, like, I'm 5 years in, I'm already 5%. 5% to me is a big number. I put myself at 50, I'm at 10%. 10% is a big number, especially when I'm already starting to feel like the change. So now's the time that you shift. That doesn't mean I'm not going to still compete in marathons and do the things I love. It's happening. But I'm now going to really prioritize some of the other stuff. Like, I've shifted the way I train for my own self. I do way more lifting than I ever did. You know me. Like, my go-to exercises were always like plyometrics, very functional training, hot HIIT workouts, really. I still do them, but I'm learning, if I want to prepare myself with a better foundation going into my late 40s, 50s, and menopause, I need to start taking that conversation more serious.
Yep. So again, I'll just kind of go into some of the nuances of adding muscle mass, just because, you know, we've talked about it in previous episodes, but again, like, I'm not going to make you go back and listen to it. It used to be thought of that the 8 to 12 rep range was ideal for hypertrophy, which is adding muscle mass. It's now accepted that the rep range doesn't matter, but your proximity to failure matters. Proximity to failure, that can be also determined by intensity, however you want to think of it, where if you're doing 10 reps of something, you probably should have been able to do maybe one or two more reps. So you need to, like, being able to do 12 and you did 10, that's proximity to failure. That's within an arm's reach. Like, you can see failure. If you could have done 18, like, you weren't even close. Same thing, but so that's an example at the lower end of the rep range. If you're doing, I wouldn't suggest doing this just because it's really painful. You could do 30 reps of something, but you're going to have to be so close to failure at that high rep range. So you can still put on muscle mass doing high reps, but it's like, do you really want to push yourself to basically failure? Because if you're doing 30 reps of something, you're basically going to have to go to failure to hit that proximity to failure that we're talking about.
I thought about that, though. I thought about you in that exact, because I remember this conversation. Like, my biggest weakness is always going to be shoulders. It just is. So anytime you talk lateral movement, like lateral raises, forward raises, I still probably don't grab heavier than an 8-pound weight. And people are like, what? I'm like, without doubt. I use your philosophy with it, though. Do you know what I mean? Instead of going and muscling out with borderline not the best form. So for me, that takes that out of the equation. I won't do it. I'm now hammering out reps to failure, but I have to get close to that 30 mark.
Okay. Yeah.
But then it's like a stepping stone. So once that becomes where I feel like, okay, now I'm literally have built a base, I will now feel comfortable going to the heavier weight, especially when we're talking a movement like that. But that is also kind of what I was saying earlier. It becomes a deterrent because I'm like, ooh, my technique isn't going to be good enough for me to justify the 4 to 5 reps or the 8 to 10. So I'm still in that 12 to 15 range, right? Mm-hmm. But now I hit that comfortably. So I'm starting to use your concept where I'm like, no, you need to like fatigue this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the actual mechanism of that's called mechanical tension. God, I should know that. I think in the actual muscle, it's the mechanical tension. God, all right. If I'm wrong, I'll correct it in the show notes, but I'm pretty sure that's the actual mechanism. So you need to have enough mechanical tension that is kind of driving either through low reps and really heavy weight or high reps and light weight. So either way you can do it. It was found that, 8 to 12 reps. It just happens to be a comfortable range where people can get close to failure. That's why that rep range was so well established for many, many years. And then the other side of it, which we talked about before, protein intake, depending on what your goals are, it can range from anything from, let's say, 1.2 to 1.6 is going to be a good general area. So that's 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight all the way up to 1.6. They've done crazy experiments where they're loading people up with as much as like 4 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. Nobody needs to do that. But the RDA of 0.8 grams per kilogram, I think, is too low. And I think that RDA is largely just going to, at best, keep you from losing muscle mass. So if you're actively training and trying to put on muscle, the RDA of 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, it's just not enough. So if you're putting in the time and effort to do strength training and lift heavy weights, but you're not prioritizing the protein and getting enough, it's going to be really frustrating. You're also going to feel worse.
I do think the hormone conversation is always going to be the game changer for our era right now. You're so ahead of your time by bringing it up and bringing the women on and paneling it, because that you can't go. I can't even answer that question without touching on that too. You know what I mean? It's like postmenopausal. So 10 years out from menopause, that's different for everyone. Some people are going through it almost like in their late 40s already. So we're still talking like in your mid 50s, you almost might be done. Your estrogen is super tied to your lean body mass. Estrogen controls so many things. It controls how your body synthesizes the protein. So now if the hormone conversation is not to be daunting. It's, if anything, I feel like that this is our time to be preaching it, to get people ahead of it by figuring it out, by getting the blood tests, by staying ahead of it. Cause there are lots of my girlfriends who have just walked through menopause with very little symptoms and effects because they were so ahead of it and they found the right doctor that did the levels. I mean, because I feel like a lot of the times we have this conversation and you're just dreading this time in your life. And it's unfortunate because this bump doesn't happen to men. It just doesn't. This bump in the road for women is a very clear bump of a change in your body. And it doesn't have to be a negative because now we have resources like this kind of a podcast and people talking about it. But you have to take action as well. It requires action. And it requires you being ahead of it, in my opinion. And it doesn't mean you're just going to skate through it. But I will tell you, I am around enough women that I have had this be explained. And I'm like, you can do it in a way that you see some effects, but once you understand how to use it, you're still working out well, you're still keeping your muscle mass, but you're also staying level. And belly fat is a big one of it though. Like signs of real different body comp changes are clear signs that it's a hormone issue. That doesn't therefore mean there's no solution, but it's outside someone like me in the gym telling you what I think you could do, because it's not something I can probably give you that will change it. First, things have to get to where they're balanced. And now everyone's going to push you towards the lifting side, because I think like even Stacey Sims was talking to Katie Couric. I loved this interview. Katie Couric's now 67 years old. And she's like, you know, Stacey, like, what do you recommend? Like, I think I'm relatively fit. And she is. Katie Couric's awesome. She's like, you know, but like my routine's usually, 7-8 pounders. I've never seen someone cut Katie Couric off immediately and be like, 40 to 50 should be your goal. She's like, pounds? She's like, yes, unwavering in Dr. Stacey Sims' answer. I loved it. Unwavering. And she was like, but she's like, I'm 67. She's like, uh-huh. That's what I mean. Like, it's not just you and I saying it as like these young little kids talking about it. This is coming down the pipeline. And if we have to keep hammering it, let's hammer it. But I'm being dead serious. So for me, I don't want to bring that answer only back to cardio, because it's actually not. Like if she was like, moderate to intense exercise is not even advised while you're going through or currently in menopause. That's a huge statement. So then you're like, wait, cardio is bad? She's like, no. But now it goes back to more your framework, where she was like, if you're premenopausal, she's like, your workout should be 2 to 3 times a week. Or excuse me, they should be 3, 4 to 5 times a week. But she's like, you're doing very fixed sprint interval work where you are doing not boot camps, but you are outside and you are briskly walking and then you're running for a minute and then you're walking again and then you're running for a minute and then you're walking. Because she's like, you need to teach the central nervous system to adapt. And the way in which you start training it to be, it's a response that is now starting to go dormant due to the estrogen part of it. That's what I'm trying to say. So you're fighting something that's not even like a fight you can win because it's not your fault. Do you get what I mean? So if you're still staying in the lane or trying to kill yourself on the treadmill, thinking more time, it's actually doing a detriment because you're not training your central nervous system to adapt to a different stress on the body. So that's what I'm saying. You have to train differently. And I actually, when I hear her talk, it sounds way more enjoyable because it actually sounds way easier than the way I train for sport.
Yeah, because you're involved in sport it requires volume.
100%. But now, it's such an eye-opener because I'm like, if anything, I want to get ridiculously strong, like without question, because I am never going to change what I love. And that's why I have to be careful on how I talk on these podcasts, because so many of my clients right now, women, are easily in their mid-40s to into their 50s. And I don't want the messaging to be like, you're screwed, forget it. Or I guarantee it's already going to happen. Coach D, why aren't I lifting heavier and my weight workouts are giving me... It's coming. I already could feel it coming and I get it. But again, everything's situational. And so a lot of it is prioritizing off season. And that will be another episode we'll have one day. And that is a perfect segue for that because there are time and places where things have to happen when they happen, because now you start into programming for marathoning and runs and big events and you can't hammer both things to its full extent.
Yeah. Maybe we're going to have to do a standalone episode at some point. Cause you mentioned something earlier about, like sprint training specifically. I'd love to get specific around like sprint training and high intensity interval training, because those two terms have been co-opted by, the fitness social media sides, and people have no idea what it means anymore. And they're very specific definitions. And I think a lot of people are doing a lot of high intensity interval training, or they think they do, and they're not getting the perceived benefit, but they're doing nothing even close to high intensity interval training. Cause a lot of people think if it's hard, it's hit. And that's not the case. But not to get too far off track, I will provide resources in the show notes around, cause you mentioned hormone replacement therapy. So I will link to Femgevity. Kristen Mallon's the co-founder of that. She was on episode 5 or 3. Either way, I'll link it and I'll link to her page. And then also Dr. Kelly Casperson, we mentioned her in the last episode as well. She's a urologist. She talks a lot about HRT, midlife menopause. Two great resources there.
I will say this too, Parker, and I don't like the phrase dumbing it down, but you have to have this conversation be a little dumbed down, as far as it could get so science-based that it gets overwhelming. And that's why I do like you and I, because we definitely play off of each other. I'm being honest. Like, I think it's really beneficial how we come together on things where I feel mine's like the cliff notes for sure. And yours is the whole novel in the best of way. Why I say is the hormone replacement, I would really hope you have a great OBGYN that sees the signs and is ahead of it. Do you get what I mean? But I feel as women, we can't wait for an external element to tell us when we think the time is time to do it. You know your body best if conversations or questions seem to be very recurring on things that just feel very off and you're already in your 40s, because it can happen that early. These blood tests, like, that's what I want you to not talk about today, but like, you were so eye-opening on that when I was in Scottsdale, and you're like, Danielle, you can just ask for this panel yourself. You could go here, have it read. Like, being ahead of it and proactive is going to be your biggest game changer. And then aligning yourself with a doctor that like really has a good reputation and really knows. So if you have a friend that went through menopause and they had a great experience with it and they referenced that doctor, I would be calling that doctor and trying to build a rapport with that person.
Yeah, because they're probably going to be hard to get into. And there's really horrifying stories for women around like describing their symptoms and just not being taken seriously. And all I can do is encourage you. Like, if your doctor dismisses you once, I would say fucking fire them. Like, you don't owe anything to your doctor. And there's a lot of resources that are not geographically bound anymore because telehealth is so readily available. So that's why I'm trying to provide some resources to people, where if you don't have a good doctor in your area or a nurse practitioner who's going to take this seriously, just look into these other options, and I'll try to find some others that I'll include in the show notes. Cause yeah, it's a big issue. OBGYNs are stretched too thin with what they're asked to do. And it's also like the lowest paid, procedural specialty out there. And that's
like things like that are so important to hear. Because I went, like, that's why I love, like, you know, so much, Parker. Like, you're very vested in the topic, and being a man is like awesome because no one's doing it. And you've been like this way before this podcast, everybody, just so you know, like, you've always been passionate about it. And I think it's incredible. So hats off to you on it. And I do think I was trying to pay you more of a compliment. Like, I just want you to not like what's becoming just your common conversation now and your world. Some of those very keynote things and like referencing the resources, like you're saying, they're so important to women like myself that are going to be listening, because also you're so good about understanding the healthcare system and the finances around things and the expense, because now we're all becoming crippled about that. Like, all of our decisions are being based on, well, is this going to be covered in insurance? Oh, well, and those are real valid concerns. Is this blood test going to cost me $1,000, right?
Yep.
But you know so much about that.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to go long in this episode, but it's worth talking about. So one of the unfortunate things is that a lot of these types of models, telehealth remote models for women's health and HRT specifically, a lot of them are going to be cash pay, or they're not going to be well reimbursed. So those practices need to make money somehow. One of the big ways they do that is by marking up the cost of blood tests. But I'll provide, again, some more links in the show notes to places where you can order your own blood tests. So Ulta Labs is one that I go to a lot. You can order direct from Quest in most states. And I'll find one more where you can order these tests and then you can say, hey, I got these done, you know, on X date, and you can get the results yourself and then kind of do one of these telehealth calls and be like, I don't need to be ordering through you. Not all of them do that, but it is one of the places that these companies can make money. And it's unfortunate that they are even in that position to begin with, because they're not adequately reimbursed by our healthcare system, because there's 14 middlemen, grabbing most of the money between the patient and the actual provider.
But I remember when we had this conversation, I was there and I did what you said, and I'm telling you, that was being proactive as the recipient of the information. Do you know what I mean? Like, that there is no reason to not be proactive with this. And there is a way to go about it and not feel like you're just going to be crushed with bills about it at all. And it shouldn't be a deterrent to not be proactive because of the financial side either.
Yeah. It's harder than it has to be, but until something changes, like waiting for your healthcare provider to tell you what to do next is just not a good avenue to kind of go down. As we've seen, just kind of with the current state of the healthcare system, so much of what we've seen has been like the immense amount of trust from previous generations in the medical system. And I mean, because at the time, right, like what were your other resources? But it's the healthcare system is not built at keeping people healthy. It's just not, there's no financial incentive. It's just not what it's built for. I'm not saying that to be negative. It's just the current state of where we are. It's harder than it has to be. You're going to have to spend more money than you should, but it is the reality of where we are right now.
Yeah.
Okay. That was a very long answer.
I know, but it was really good.
Yeah. Leanna, thanks for kickstarting that conversation.
100%.
Okay. Anything else to add before we wrap this one up?
Nope. I think that was thorough.
I agree.
And I feel like you and I are very passionate about what we talk about, and we just have a lot of knowledge on some stuff. And so sometimes what seems to be a simple answer, when I really sit and start writing notes down, all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I have a lot of thoughts on this. So I try to condense it as best I can, but that's also the fun of this format of like hearing what you have to say. Oh, then I have another thought.
Yeah.
Right.
No, exactly. There's like, we have a whole backlog of questions, and you see some of them with like 8 versions of the same question. I don't think either of us want to answer it, but I think we'll get through them at some.
For sure.
Okay. Danielle, thanks for coming on again.
Thanks, Parker.
All right. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time. Hey everyone, that's all for today's show. I want to thank you so much for stopping by and watching, especially if you've made it all the way to this point. If you'd like to be notified when new episodes are going to be released, feel free to subscribe and make sure you hit the bell button as well. To learn more about today's guest, feel free to look in the description. You can also visit the podcast website, which is exploringhealthpodcast.com. That website will also be linked in the description. As always, likes, shares, comments are a huge help to me and to this channel and to the show. So any of that you can do, I would really appreciate. And again, thank you so much for watching, and I'll see you next time.